Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. In most episodes of this podcast, we make some mention of the equity market, but as Australians, our true investment passion is generally residential property, even for equity investors, I find in many cases. The last few years for those in Sydney and Melbourne and Hobart, anyway, really that love affair has been reinforced. But there's a sharp turnaround last year, 2018, it's really starting to bite for a lot of people. To understand what is really happening in the residential property market and what it might mean for the wider economy, today I'm speaking with Ivan Cahoon, NAB's Chief Economist for Markets, whose CV is incredibly impressive as an economist, but also holds a commercial pilot's license, which I think is a first for this podcast. Ivan, thanks so much for joining me.
Great to be here, Gemma.
And a commercial pilot. We have not had one of those.
No, I haven't done much of that recently, but yes, it's a passion.
Good to know you can. That's the important thing.
I'm always willing. I always hope that something goes wrong in the cockpit and they announce, could someone help land the plane? I'll be the first one pressing the button.
Oh, I might fly with you from now on if I get a bit nervous. It'd be good to have someone with us.
Sure.
So, Ivan, can you tell us a little bit about what has happened in the property market over the last decade? It's been pretty fascinating. I think we feel like we know what has happened based on newspaper headlines and talking to friends and our own personal experiences. But as an economist, what have you seen?
Well, look, in my presentations, I have this list of 12 different factors that explain what's been happening in the property market. And I'm probably missing out a few, but in Australia, there's been this long, long period of house prices going up in most of the country. Mm. The factors I put in there, and which I'd say is a construct, so... Firstly, population growth has been very, very strong, particularly recently. A lot of that's been immigration, and also we've had lots of foreign students as well, which drives the demand for certain types of property. We've had for a time underbuilding and slow land release, which has been important in certain cities, Sydney I'd say particularly. It's not saying that's still the case. We've had some very strong foreign investment at times. There's always been quite a lot of foreign investment into Australian residential property, but for 3 or 4 years there was another leg up and the Chinese foreign investment was huge. We've had this trend really been going on since the early 1990s to much lower interest rates, and that has been, again, a big feature in the last little while. We've had some differing economic cycles depending on what part of the country you're in. So you've had a mining boom affecting parts of the country, and you've had obviously after the mining boom when rates came down further, you've had better conditions in the non-mining states or parts of the economy. Then you've also had APRA and the banks tightening up on lending standards, which has been an effect recently. There's also prospectively some changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax discount if there's a change of government. So there's a mixture of all of those forces going on. And I'd say mainly you think about demand, so interest rates, population, then lending standards and tighter regulation on foreigners on the demand side. And then local economic conditions. And on the supply side, a little bit inflexible supply of houses coming together, and that's produced some very big price rises in certain cities. And then you had that whole downturn in the mining sectors, which boomed beforehand and have been doing different things. So Darwin and Perth prices have been falling for 4 or 5 years. While Sydney and Melbourne continue to increase. So a lot of different forces and factors going on.
Do you mind giving some specific numbers about, particularly Sydney and Melbourne, you know, is where the majority of the population lives. Those two cities are pretty massive. Even by global standards, a very big city. So personal experience of this because we were looking to get a larger house, and we watch house prices increase by $500,000 in 6 months in some places. Like, it was quite astonishing. Yep. Like, we're saving, but goodness me, did not save $500,000.
Yep.
It was quite astonishing, I think, for a lot of people to watch those prices move. Percentage terms over those sort of few years?
Yeah, I think I'm speaking roughly here, so just jumping off my chart. So median house prices in Sydney between about 2003 and 2007 or 8, they're pretty flat, around 425,000, 450,000. Mm-hmm. And then over that, from 2008 to late 2018, they approximately doubled to 900,000. So that's the middle house that's selling. So that, you know, was close to 100% increase. Mm-hmm. I mean, Melbourne didn't have that flat period that Sydney had. It's been pretty much one-way traffic. At the start of the 2000s, Melbourne was around 200,000 for a median price and is up to 650,000. So that's that's nearly a trebling, right? So some very big percentage increases.
Huge.
And I think one of the things that is true is that there's an amount of debt to buy a house, and then there's the amount you have to pay on your mortgage. So that's where the interest rate is very important. And interest rates have come down a long way over a long period of time. So some part of the increase in prices is because rates are very low. Mm. So you could say if rates halved, then you could afford double the mortgage and you're paying roughly the same amount of cash flow. Mm. So that is one aspect. Now, that only works while you have a job. Right, because then
that is going to be a statement of the podcast.
Well,
yes.
It is important. So one of the things when you talk about later in the questions about what will determine how this unfolds, it's whether unemployment stays low and whether the economy stays strong. So there's those sorts of issues, but other cities have had different performances. I would say that in Sydney and Melbourne, what has been real, and Canberra as well, what's been really important recently is that combination of very strong population growth. So these cities have attracted a lot of the population after the mining downturn. Mm. So Perth and Brisbane slowed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They've also had more than their fair share of foreign investor flows into these big popular cities.
Mm.
Sydney has obviously got a very big Chinese community.
Mm.
That's, I think it is, if you weren't born in Australia, the biggest number of people that were born were from Chinese origin now.
Mm.
That wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago. It was further down the line. They've got a lot of foreign students as well. So all of those have been important. And Sydney, really, for quite a long time, wasn't releasing much land. So any demand increases with a fixed supply tend to push into prices a lot.
So what are your thoughts about where we find ourselves now? They were the primary drivers for those really substantial increases and that, you know, 100% increase in relatively short period of time. That's pretty dramatic. And also worth noting that that's just price increase. When we think about equity returns, in inverted commas, you take the yield into consideration, whereas prices, you're really just talking about property, just a price increase. That's it. We're not talking about any kind of rental yield or anything else. Straight line growth in prices is pretty astonishing in any market. So where do you see us now, sort of 12 months on from the end of that?
Yeah, well, I think if you, it's very different depending on what capital city you look at. So Darwin and Perth, as I said, have been falling for 4 or 5 years now.
Mm. They've probably switched off by now.
Yeah, Sydney and Melbourne have only recently started to see a decline in price, and most people say they're back to like 2 2016 levels, say in Sydney. Canberra and Hobart prices have still been going up in the last year. So there's some local conditions. So again, local conditions are very important. And if we said something like Port Hedland, which was one of the epicentres of the mining boom, I mean, prices went crazy there. And to that is where there was, I'd say, a bubble. I can understand why it happened, but it has well and truly unwound, and prices seem to have bottomed there and starting to slowly, gradually recover. So in terms of Sydney, Melbourne, those are the cities that are particularly beginning to experience price falls. And what has changed there? I think, firstly, there have been changes to take the heat out of the investor market, which was very, very strong, particularly in Sydney. So some of that was foreign investment. So there were increases in stamp duties, policing of foreign investment restrictions. China actually made it harder for its residents to get money out of the country. And then APRA said, we're a bit worried about how much investor lending's going on and how much interest-only lending's going on. And they tightened, put a number of prudential restrictions on, which affected the investor market. And I think there was just naturally also a bit of the market overshot, and then eventually, presumably, a few people started selling, and then prices had got out of the reach of a lot of people, as you gave the example of how quickly they went up in a short period of time. And I guess the other thing it's worth saying about the housing market is you don't buy your house and sell your house every month. So,
no.
So that's where sometimes, if you look back in history, house prices in Australia have tended to go up, and as you said in our introduction before the podcast started, and then they've gone sideways for 10 years. So they go up to a level. So this is a different cycle in that house prices have been falling. But part of that, I think, is they went up so much. And part of that even comes back to the whole apartment boom driven out of China, because a lot of people were buying houses to get the land to build apartments. So there's a bit of circularity there.
So, question without notice, I apologise for that. You mentioned interest-only loans and this concern about investor lending from APRA, and it's received a lot of attention. One thing that has received quite a bit of attention is this interest-only cliff, the number of loans that will roll off the interest-only period to become principal and interest. A few stories in the paper about people who say they didn't realise that was going to happen. Strikes me as somewhat astonishing. Surely you learned that in school, that at some point you might have to pay back your actual loan. But your thoughts about how much impact that's going to have, people actually suddenly having to go from a repayment at a low interest rate on an interest-only basis to a principal and interest repayment, which might be double depending on the term of the loan from what they were originally paying. Do you think that's going to have a big impact?
Yeah, look, we've...
I understand it's sort of the next couple of years are when that's really going to hit, because they're usually on five-year terms.
Yeah, so we've had a look at that a bit. So you're right, most... The takeoff or the really big increase in interest-only loans started in about 2014.
Right.
And most of them are five-year loans. So we are in the window where we will get a really good look into what are the issues there. However, we also can look in our data. NABS, as you would expect, has got lots of data on mortgages and interest-only mortgages. And while most of them are five-year loans, lots of them are three-year loans as well. Okay. So it's like roughly 80%, 15%, and then another 5% are, you know, 1, 2, and 3, 4 four-year loans. So what I can see so far is there hasn't been a noticeable pickup in problems for those three-year loans that were taken out at the same time as five-year loans were taken out.
Right.
So I've been monitoring those for a couple of years. There has been some increase in the, it's, it hasn't been so much being an interest-only loan or a principal interest loan. It's been investor loans.
Yeah.
I think that's where you've seen a little bit of a tick up in some stress or arrears. And I think that is related to the fact that investor lending went, you know, crazy. And APRA, I think, has done a good job in noticing that and tightening up on that. And that's where somewhere like Perth and Darwin, they're good examples or templates, because we saw big increases in prices. We saw building. We saw a lot of apartments. And then we saw an economic downturn. Vacancy rates went up. Rents went down. Prices went down. And arrears went up, and both for investors and for owner-occupiers. So I think that's one of the things there that I think is important is vacancy rates and rents and the importance of the investor in the market, because in the end, the investor isn't like an owner-occupier who, if they've got their, you know, remain employed, continue to service their mortgage and look through for the next 20 or 30 years, whereas an investor will be quite concerned if prices are falling, if the unit, which is what I imagine most investment properties are, doesn't have a tenant in it, and they're trying to, you know, pay
a mortgage
with rental income, and there is no rental income. So vacancy rates are very, very important.
Right.
And then rents, what happens to rents are then important, because like most assets, the price of the asset has a relationship to the cash flows underneath the asset.
It could be very interesting to see how that plays out in Brisbane. We talk about all the new apartments coming on in Sydney, but I understand Brisbane's had quite a bit of a negative experience on the apartment front already.
Yeah, I think that one's really interesting, because as a bank, NAB, and I think the other banks also did this, we could see that Brisbane was building too many apartments 2 to 3 years ago. So we tightened right up on our lending to developers. It became very hard to get a loan. Not as an apartment buyer, but if you were a developer in Brisbane. Because we just said there might be some problems
there. Yeah, there's a real supply issue.
But if I look at the vacancy rates in Brisbane, they're still very, very low. And that's been different to what we expected. We would have thought that they would have moved up a lot, and that rents would have come off. And I think rents have come down a little bit in Brisbane. But what we've seen is that there's been quite a bit of interstate migration from Sydney, particularly New South Wales, back into Queensland. And I think we often see that when house prices get very expensive in Sydney, people start moving out of Sydney into cheaper places, particularly into Queensland. But recently also we can see that into Hobart, which has been one of those very fast performing capital cities, and one I take a keen interest in as a Tasmanian. So
do you know, all the Tasmanians who come on this podcast are very proud Tasmanians. My husband is a proud Tasmanian.
We
got married in Tassie. I think it's beautiful down there, but I kind of feel for the native Tasmanians. When you work in a local market down there, you don't get paid Sydney wages.
No.
So if you're trying to compete with people from Sydney and Melbourne buying your property, you're going to just get priced out in no time.
That's true. And that's how sometimes with property markets, again, things only, the market trades, the whole of the market, you have to want to sell your house to get that, realise that price. But if you don't, then sort of an unrealised gain until the price changes. And then now what's happening, turnover slowed down, but buyers and sellers, they've changed their behaviour. So buyers aren't quite as rushing around, and I think in Sydney people know there are lots of apartments to come on the market, so that's part of the reason prices have been coming down. And I think rents are beginning to slow off and probably drop in Sydney as well.
So on a more macro scale, you know, we all have this very personal feeling about property. As you say, you know, we feel very wealthy even though nothing's actually happened. You know, we're not selling the house, but we feel a lot better that it, apparently it's worth more money. We saw what the neighbour's place went for.
Do you think that, like, I actually don't think that
you don't think we think that
part of this cycle.
That's very interesting.
I think that was part of the cycle in the early 2000s. Mm. People did. I remember my wonderful mentor, Don Stammer, who I imagine many of the listeners would read in The Australian and hear about. But he used to say the first topic of conversation at every dinner party
yep.
was about house prices and how wealthy you'd become, and also about we could see in the statistics people were drawing down on their mortgages, buying cars, buying home equity, sort of release stuff. Whereas this cycle, I think, a bit of a buzzword, the narrative around housing has actually been about the affordability crisis, about how our children aren't going to be able to afford houses. And if you look at some of the indicators like consumer confidence, in the early 2000s it went up a lot. This cycle it hasn't gone up particularly at all. And if you look at retail sales, they haven't boomed either. Now, car sales have been pretty strong, and they've slowed down, so maybe there's a bit of an effect there. But I think car sales have also been affected by the tightening in lending standards as well. So it's a little bit uncertain. I'm not as clear about that. But I just don't think there's been that real boom. And instead of net equity withdrawal, we've definitely seen continuing injection of equity into mortgages. People have been paying down mortgages rather than going the other way.
So that's really important. As I said, this is the value of having an economist talk about this subject rather than you and your friends. So I'm at the stage of life where we were upgrading our house because we have small children. And all of our friends are at the stage of life where they're upgrading their house because of small children. So we were all talking about it, all talking about the value of prices, of housing, and the impact of the growth of house prices. If you are not in that bubble and that little stage of life where it's imperative that we all find a big enough house for the kids, and then we wanted a backyard for the first time, and you need to be near a good school and all those things, then you're saying at a wider population level there wasn't anywhere near as significant an impact as we would have seen in previous cycles.
On other spending.
Yeah, okay. Well,
I think that's what I look at in the numbers I see. The other thing that you just mentioned, upgraders. So upgraders should love falling house prices, right?
Yeah,
because
we were fairly happy about it.
The bigger properties, 10% fall in the bigger property saves you money. So this is a good market for upgraders.
You're absolutely right, the affordability issue, even for people in my situation where we were trying to buy property that was appropriate for our stage of life, i.e. the kids had somewhere to run around, we were still concerned that our kids wouldn't be able to afford such a thing, that all of the decent land was being taken to build apartments, and those apartments were so expensive our children wouldn't be able to buy one. Now, you know, working in the sector I do, I was of the view that at some point it flattens out and our kids will be fine and maybe they won't want to live where we live anyway. But we had other friends who were like, should we maybe borrow to buy an apartment for our children, who are two and four, so that they have something to move into. But that sort of assumes some pretty spectacular long-term demographics.
I think partly there is a final constraint because it's how much income everyone earns. And one thing we know, and we just had some wages numbers earlier this week, and wages have only been growing around 2 to 2.5% in Australia in recent years. So it's growing very slowly.
Yeah.
So property prices cannot just keep galloping off forever in that environment, because you can't borrow money. There's the banks will lend you the maths of the home loan calculator. Put in that and the deposit, and it takes a long time to save up a deposit. So eventually the price becomes...
There's a natural cap on it.
There will be a cap.
Unless you are totally okay with foreign buying, that's a different thing.
Yes, but I mean, foreign buying is only supposed to be for only newly built apartments.
Yeah, there's obviously some real political challenges with that, which, you know, have seen some impediments imposed for selling of property to
That definitely, I mean, the Foreign Investment Review Board had their annual report released early this week or late last week, and certainly Chinese buying has come down a lot.
Yeah, quite
dramatic. I think the peak for that was 2 or 3 years ago, clearly.
So the question then, if we think that the wealth effect, this idea that everyone feels richer because their house is worth more, is not having a hugely significant impact on retail spending and all those sorts of things, possibly cars, how important is the residential property market to the overall economy? So when we look at it as a driver of economic growth, a driver of employment, how significant?
It's pretty big. As a share of the economy, residential construction's typically around 5% of
GDP.
That's
construction, yeah.
Yeah, which doesn't sound that big, 1/20. Really, in this cycle, it's been a very big cycle. It got up to something like 6% of GDP. Mm. Now, what typically happens with housing, though, and why it's so important, is that it doesn't change from, you know, growing at 2% to 3%. It goes from plus 10% to minus 10%. So you get 20% changes in the cycle. It's very cyclical.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, a 6% share of the economy changing by 20%, that's a 1.2% difference in GDP growth.
Yeah.
Right. And GDP is growing around 2.75%. Mm. So if it all happened in 1 year, that 2.75% could slow down to 1.5%.
Yeah, wow.
Right. So that's why it can be very significant, because its cycles are so big.
Mm.
Then the other thing that's important is that there are spillover effects into other parts of the economy. So, you know, when you buy a house, you often will buy new furniture, new white goods, new electrical goods, etc. So you've got that turnover.
You might spend on an electrician, a plumber, a chimney guy, a roofer, and all the
real estate agents.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the people we've spent on in the last 6 weeks. We've managed to, I think, chip into pretty much every sector of the economy.
Yeah. Mm. So that's important. So it does tend to be pretty important, or very important. And I think the numbers we just checked before I came in, I think there's 1.2 million people employed in construction, but around 2/3 of that is residential. So 750,000.
Wow.
And to the extent, like if you got a 20% drop, that could be 150,000 people directly.
Wow.
Now, if that happened over 3 years, it would be 4,000 jobs lost a month, which is very sad, but it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Mm.
And I guess one important counterbalance in this cycle is we're seeing quite a lot of infrastructure construction going on. Mining's picking up. Non-residential construction's picking up in Sydney and Melbourne in particular. So there are some jobs around that people could switch between, I think. So that's important. But look, it is important to the economy, and the housing cycle's always been a very cyclical part of the economy. So yes, very important.
So $1 million question. We're in this scenario where things have slowed pretty dramatically. And as you say, those swings are dramatic, certainly relative to, I mean, mining's pretty cyclical, but, you know, many other, education, for example, you don't see those swings. So big slowdown. How long do you think this is going to play out? And what are the things that you see as being the risks to the upside and the downside of this scenario? Because as you say, people may go and get employed in another sector. This infrastructure spending is going on, which is really positive and so on. But if those jobs lost can't be absorbed, or, you know, what would be the risks of those not being absorbed, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So I think there's two or three different things to think through. So one is we are going to get lower housing construction. So the apartment building boom in Sydney is slowing down. We've probably got another 3 to 6 months finishing off a lot of them, and then it's in the down cycle. Just like mining construction boom, the big mines, they were in their down cycle, and that is a drag on that sector, and it's probably for a couple of years where it slowed down. And if you look at, say, Perth, there is still a fall in building approvals happening there.
Still. Wow.
That's 4 to 5 years on. Now, Perth's been interesting because it's been losing people to the eastern states.
Right.
Right. So probably they've gone back to where they once came from after the mining boom for employment reasons. So that's one effect to look through. And then the other one is, to what extent is there a wealth effect that it impacts through into consumption? And does it increase savings? Do people start feeling less wealthy?
Interesting, yeah.
You know, because then if you start to say, oh, I better save some more money, again, I can't see much evidence of that at all in Sydney or Melbourne at the moment. And again, I think it's because prices went up so much and they've come down a little bit in, you know, comparison to how much they went off. And were people feeling really wealthy at the peak? Maybe some were, but I actually think people were feeling more worried about how high prices were. So I think a lot of it's going to depend for the economy on whether unemployment stays low. But for investors and for prices, it really depends on how much vacancy rates there are, and is there a lot of empty property, and in which case rents come down, in which case prices, I think, adjust as well.
So one additional question that will have an effect on consumption. So interest rates are still very low by any historical standard. Mm-hmm. There's now been a real, the RBA is being very clear that there are some potential scenarios in which they would reduce rates rather than increase them, which have been the assumption for a while. Do you think people will start paying down mortgages more aggressively? Obviously, mortgages are much higher than they've ever been in history, and people have been able to afford them because of the lower rates, as you point out. If there is any risk that those rates will increase people, do they pay down more aggressively? Have we not seen this scenario before?
Look, I think what we've been seeing as a bank is that, and if you're on a variable rate mortgage, most variable rate mortgages, if the interest rate falls, the bank doesn't automatically drop your
interest rate. Yeah.
So you actually repay more quickly. And that's what banks have been seeing. So that hasn't been good for bank profitability or shareholders in banks, because the mortgage book has been growing more slowly. But it's good for a bank from a credit perspective, because people are getting ahead in their repayments. So if they were to lose their job or have, you know, some family illness and not be able to work for a while, they're ahead of their payments. So it's actually built in a buffer. If rates came down some more, which is quite a reasonable possibility, I think now. NAB, we were thinking, like the Reserve Bank, the economy looked quite good. The world looked quite good. Obviously, late last year, we had the equity market fall quite sharply. We've had the house prices coming off, housing construction slowing a bit more. Retail wasn't that great over Christmas. So it just doesn't look quite as good as it did 3 to 6 months ago. And that's what the RBA has been saying. Their central scenario, they're still inclined to the more positive view that unemployment will keep coming down, wages will lift a bit, and therefore inflation will go back into the band. And it's really important how unemployment turns out, because that's the linchpin that controls how far house prices fall and allows people to keep paying their mortgages. But their other scenario is actually maybe house price falls, stop people spending, unemployment moves up a bit. That's the scenario they cut interest rates. What would people do? I think whenever unemployment's going up, that tends to be more of a driver of savings behaviour than the interest rate story. I think people just keep paying their mortgages off each month. So I don't think they'd pay it off more quickly. But if they were to lose their job, then obviously they end up paying it off more slowly.
Ivan, all of this is very valuable to everyone who's looking at the housing market. And the investors in the equity market need to consider this for their equity portfolios as well as their largest asset, which is their home. Any other thoughts you'd like to leave people with?
Look, I think overall the Australian economy is still going quite well. The scenario we've been talking about is about some sectoral differences in the economy. So when I think about that, and it's probably relevant to equity portfolio, sectoral equity portfolio selection, but the housing market has had a very big long boom and it's now having a correction, and there's going to be more of that to come. And businesses exposed to either declining house prices or turnover or housing construction, they're probably going to find that the period it's weak for the next few years. There is still some very strong activity in government. So you mentioned, I think it was education or health, but health and education are growing very strongly because of the past growth in the population. Defence is growing strongly. Infrastructure is growing strongly. The farm sector has had its challenges on the East Coast, but we've had some rains in Queensland, so I think that will begin to bounce back. So there's a variety of sectoral stories. On housing, I'd just keep watching rents and vacancy rates, but if they, they're probably going to rise. I think Sydney is the most challenged of any of the capital cities at the moment. But like we know, out of often you'll be looking for opportunities as well. So if prices are coming down, that provides the opportunity for some people to get into the market at lower prices than they have been before. And of course, the not giving advice directly, but property investors should familiarise themselves with the policy of the opposition, which is about a change to negative gearing, a change to the capital gains tax discount, and speak to your accountant or wealth advisor about what that means, because it's not, it will have an effect on returns over a period. Depends how long you want to hold them for. And after if there is a change of government, you won't be able to negatively gear existing property. Like newly purchased existing properties. All existing before the election will be grandfathered or whenever they bring it in. But afterwards, it's slightly different.
Yeah, so it'll only be newly built property.
Newly built.
Yeah. That point about grandfathering existing arrangements, people may not be familiar with the term grandfathering. I did read where the term came from, which is quite weird. But the term simply means that existing arrangements are protected under the existing legislation. So for people who have been thinking about it as a strategy, you know, you need to be aware that it will change, and therefore, you know, your window to employ that strategy is pretty limited. But it would be quite interesting to consider whether people will actually hang on to their investment properties for longer if there is a change of legislation, because unwinding that arrangement means you can never do it again?
Yeah, I think that would be another factor that should decrease turnover of houses.
Yeah, yeah, wouldn't it? Mm.
For all that property. And it also changes the resale characteristics, because once you're selling any property, you can't sell it to an investor.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Right, because even if you bought a newly, built, the next sale can't be to an investor. So,
could be an investor who's going to positively gear it, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. So they can offset the interest costs and any other costs. Yeah, it might have to have a very strong yield, which hasn't been the case for a long time.
But yeah, negative
gear. So you won't get the investor who's happy to take any kind of loss because they know they can write it off on the tax. There'll be someone who wants to manage the cost quite carefully in that scenario, I imagine. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens if that is legislated.
And I think that there have been a few discussions in the market recently about investors are coming back into the market a little bit, probably because of that anticipation of perhaps a change in government. And my final thought would be to watch investor lending in the data. That's been a really good lead indicator of house prices. And it's been going down recently, as you would expect.
Yeah.
So investors are not going to typically buy into a falling market until they think it's getting close to the bottom. So watch what investors are doing. That will be a good hint as to when the bottom's been reached.
Yeah, when things are going to turn around. Ivan, you and your team produce some fabulous insights, and this is obviously one area people are very interested in, but you cover such a range of things about the Australian economy and the likely impact on individual businesses and their portfolios and all of those different things. Things that people really need to take into consideration as they work through their financial plans. How can people follow you and the work that you're doing?
Well, you can speak to your banker or your advisor, and they can sign you up. But you have to be a customer of NAB or one of our subsidiaries. As long as that's the case, we can sign you up to the research.
Beautiful.
Some of it, obviously, there is a little bit of research which is for wholesale investors and not relevant for a retail investor. But most of it, the economics, the quarterly property survey, residential and commercial, which would be interesting to obviously property investors. There's the NAB Business Survey, which is a great indicator of what's happening in the economy. There's our forecasts on the economy. We've got a podcast each day, which you know about, which tells everyone what happened overnight and why it happened. So
that is called The Morning Call. It's incredibly popular. You know, brokers and investment houses around the country use it. Some international groups use it now too, don't they? It's very popular indeed, and they do a fabulous job of distilling the day's news into sort of 10-15 minutes of everything you need to know.
So get onto your advisor and say, send me the list, and they can do that.
Fantastic. Ivan, thank you so much for your time today.
No worries.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.